Informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Good evening and welcome to The Big Picture. I'm Matt, your host. Thank you for the panel for joining me today. We do hope you can hear us. We've moved over to talks today. The light is on, so good evening. We'll be discussing a range of issues in the news this week. We'll be discussing Obama's State of the Union address, the riots in Ukraine over and a rejection by the Ukrainian government to move towards the EU. And we'll also be looking at Michael Gove's admission that state schools should be more like private schools. But before we go any further, we decided to introduce our panel. So we have...
Hi, I'm Zoe. I'm a second-year politics student.
Hi, I'm Luke, and I'm a second-year law student.
And hello, I'm Kieran, but I've got out the room for a second.
He'll be back in a second, but Kieran was with us this evening. Thank you all for joining us. It's nice to be in talk. It's actually my first time in here, so we'll see how this goes. It's very, very strange not having a board to look at or anything. Kieran's back. So yes, thank you for joining us. We'll start off with Obama and his State of the Union address. President Barack Obama has promised action on inequality in his speech to Congress. He focuses on tackling economic inequality and pledges to take steps without legislation, notably through executive orders, wherever possible, announcing a rise in the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour for new federal contract workers. He's asked for an immigration bill to start going through Congress again, and he's also had some different rebuttals from the Republican Party in light of this, who have continued to blame the economic woes of America upon his policies. So what I want to ask the panel really is, what does the State of the Union address say about Obama's presidency and America's broader political environment as it stands today?
Well, I think the key there was the bit that you started with. Obama made a load more promises, and Obama is pretty good at making promises, and Obama has been making promises ever since the year and a half before he was elected. When he was campaigning, he was making promises then, like promises to close Guantanamo Bay and similar sorts of promises to pull in lots of people. And as far as action goes, as this State of the Union has shown, we've actually not seen as much as Obama would certainly like to see, and I think that America would like to see. And Obama's continued to use his very good oratory skills to try and appeal to people, but ultimately it is promises that Obama is making, and the effects and the consequence of those promises are not being seen.
Now, it's not that Obama doesn't want to pursue these promises or that they're invalid promises. The fact is that he is up against a Congress which despises him and which strangles him and puts him into a position where he is unable to fulfill his promises, which are his democratic right, which people voted for him for. When it comes to things like Guantanamo Bay, it's not that he didn't want to close it. It's that it was rejected by Congress and so on and so forth. And actually, I think what we saw in the State of the Union address was an Obama prepared to finally admit that after 6 years of wrangling with Congress and trying to do it on their terms, it's no longer worth it. So you are going to see an influx of executive orders as we come into the last 2 years of Obama's presidency. And I do actually think that Obama is trying his hardest to make a better America, but he's just constrained by a completely right-wing held Congress.
Your optimism is infectious. I'm sorry I don't share it.
Well, unfortunately, that's because of your side of the party, not mine.
To further off from what Kieran said, I read in The New Yorker, Ryan Leitzer wrote that Obama's speech was kind of like breaking up with an ambivalent lover. You know, he was sort of happy to hook up with Congress occasionally and kind of work with them when he wanted to, but he was also happy to go his own way. And they also said that he flouted his executive ability in the sort of way that you'd show off to someone that you got with and was like, I can do better than you. So, which I thought was quite an apt description, actually, because this was very much Obama saying, you know, sod it, I've tried to do it with you guys, I've tried bipartisanship, which has always been in part of his five previous State of the Union addresses. This time he was like, you know, I'm going to slash the red tape. He specifically said, slash the red tape, going to try and get rid of the bureaucracy. This is very much, you know, a man who can see the light at the end of the tunnel and realizes this is what needs to be done, and previous work, it hasn't happened.
I think it will be interesting to see if that's the case, because one of the criticisms that is made of Obama frequently, and we've seen it with a lot of issues, that he has been slow and that he has stalled over. And we can talk about the fact that he struggled to negotiate with Congress and that he's not played politics particularly well. I mean, all presidents face this natural separation of powers, this battle that happens between the arms of government in America, and most of them are able to make some progress. Obama hasn't. Obama has been dragging his heels. Obama we talk about bipartisanship, we saw his stubbornness over things like the debt ceiling, even when there were Republicans that were willing to make an offer. And I mean, I'm not a Republican by any means. I stay away from the partisan side of America. I think it's different. I just look at the issues, and the issue is that Obama will not go down as a particularly successful president because he's promising, because he's dragging his heels. And if he is going to change that, and if he's actually going to do something and he's going to use executive orders, so be it. That would be great to see, provided, of course, they are used for the right things. But I'm sceptical, and I remain sceptical, and I will be sceptical until we actually see the effects of what he's doing.
I mean, doesn't Kieran have a point, though, Luke, that actually a lot of Republicans, I mean, even if some Republicans are willing to concede on some issues like the debt ceiling, the vast majority of them are saying, well, we're not going to concede on this. We're going to absolutely obstruct the president and just oppose virtually everything he does. Surely that's not the president's fault. Surely that's the Republican Party's fault.
The question was I'll just, before you, Kieran.
I mean, just to fairly place the blame is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm not for a minute standing up for the American political system, because I think at the moment that there is way too much infighting that's going on, and that's why, you know, the rates of Congress approval are about 11% or so. You know, they're really, really low. But at the same time, Obama he's not done enough to work with them. You know, he's not been more subtle with things. He's just piled everything on at once, and he's pushed a lot of things. You know, healthcare, massive agenda, which isn't really necessary for the economic side of things, but Obama has pushed and pushed and pushed, and he's not conceded on other elements. And it's just, I think, a lack of politics all round, really, and Obama is to blame for that. He's got to bear his share of the blame for it.
Look, Obama has his faults. From what I understand, you know, he's a president which doesn't like to deal with Congress, whether it's his own party or whether it's the Republican Party. He doesn't have a great presence on the Hill in the same way that someone like Clinton did. But I think, you know, that at the end of the day, we're talking about a party which held the country hostage when it came to debt ceiling over his Health Care Act, his Affordable Health Act, which had been democratically approved by Congress and by the Supreme Court, and yet at the end of the day, they still decided to hold the country hostage for their own selfish presidential, their own selfish political needs. And I think we really need to reevaluate here how damaging the Republican side of the House is and what they are doing is for the country.
Oh, absolutely, it's appalling that they were using the healthcare as an excuse for something like the debt ceiling, which needed to be cleared. But I don't think you can firmly lay this or simply lay this at the hands of the Republicans as well, because Obama has been unable to basically use the negotiation that's required in order to try and get more results from Congress. And I'm just saying that the State of the Union address, which is obviously the thing that we were talking about originally, is more of an example of stuff that he's saying he's going to do and he's not actually going to end up doing.
All right, we've had Seb and Elliot join us. Thank you very much for joining us today. We'll have Seb on this next.
Thanks, Hank. I've only just gone in, so apologies if I go over anything anyone else has said, but I think point of Obama and Congress, obviously I think they both have to share the blame. The whole point of the way the American political system was set up was to ensure that no one party held the presidency in both houses of Congress. So one of the areas of, well, many areas of checks and balances, which was specifically designed to ensure that, you know, limit any one party's power. But the flip side of that is, of course, it requires parties to work together. And has worked very well over the years when parties have been willing to compromise. But the minute we've seen throughout Obama's, well, one and a bit terms, that either one of the parties isn't willing to compromise, the whole thing does fall apart, and it's really very difficult to get anything done, which is the government shutdown, you know, really thing, do the basic things. As to the point about Luke saying the healthcare maybe taking on too much and not focusing on the economy, well, I think on one hand here, Republicans in Congress trying to repeal Obamacare, well, it was over 40 times last time, I don't know how many times now, and not really passing any jobs bill. And you've got to remember, it's in effect, healthcare is, of course, linked to the economy for many people. Medical bankruptcies. Well, it'll be massive for the people who are going bankrupt beforehand because of healthcare costs and who couldn't get it. And I don't think...
Or for the ones whose healthcare costs are being pushed up. It's going to be...
Right, Will.
Sorry, I know I'm away from...
That's all right, Luke. Luke is
only
safe.
Those whose coverage... who was effectively drunk in a very, very poor status beforehand. And I think it's unfair, I think, to say the person can only focus on an economic agenda. It's not allowed to try and get through any other landmark piece of legislation, otherwise he's considered to be taking on too much.
Zoe, we'll go to you next, yeah.
Just to sort of go back to the question about the State of the Union address, I was just going to say that it was sort of badly received by the media generally. I think the National Review said that Obama would have to try very hard to give a bad speech, but he gave it his best shot when he delivered this one. Right-wing trash. Anyway, but it's the people that really matter, and we haven't had all the polls in yet, and the polls will be going on for sort of weeks and months to see how people responded to the State of the Union address, but the initial findings so far have been positive. They did a poll in the swing state of Colorado and Denver, and people responded warmly to Obama's plans on minimum wage and sort of rising the minimum wage and education loans and that kind of thing, and surely that's the most important thing, is the people's response rather than what the media are sort of saying. And Congress, we can go on and on about the partisanship in Congress, but it's the people that really matter.
We'll go to Elliot and then we'll go to Luke.
Yeah, I've read about Obama's State of the Union address, and essentially he said not very much which is actually going to have any effect on anything he's going to do in the remaining of his presidency. Obama has become almost a president without a role to fulfill. He's done everything. He's not done everything he set out to do, but he's got no more aims or objectives to try and achieve. His healthcare thing was probably his last battle, and that's it now. Seb, I spoke to Seb about this before, and he said, oh, well, there's immigration you might try and tackle. Well, good luck with that in America. I'm sure that will go down very well. I'm sure Obama will go on and try and cause more controversy after controversy. I think Obama is essentially for the next three years, there's going to be no president of America, essentially, because there's going to be no sort of change.
That's a very broad claim, Elliot. Well, it's a very bold claim.
Apart from, in fact, I don't think there'll be a single issue, unless the economy goes belly up again, which is possible, which would be of any massive point. Of course, there'll be small issues that will come up, but then nothing will be as big as, say, like, the economy, or, say, like, Obamacare. I think all the sort of things that President Obama, that people thought he stood for, or that President Obama wanted to do, he's either tried or he's done. He's run out of ideas, and I think that's bad for an American president.
On the other hand, though, I mean, he's cut taxes for small businesses. He's still implementing Obamacare. He's still got immigration reform to go
through. Yeah, still implementing Obamacare. You know, he's already done it.
Surely that's still issues that he's still going to focus on.
He's not going to be doing very much at all. That's what I'm trying to say. He's going to do something.
A very bold claim by Elliot there. Zoe, we'll go to you.
I was just wondering, can we get a soundbite of Elliot saying that and return to this in a year and see whether he's right? I'd really enjoy that.
We shall note this day.
Yes,
the 5th of February, 2014.
Next year, big picture experiment. I hope Elliot's wrong, just because I'm a huge fan of Obama. I'll freely say that. But he might be right, and I think it'd be interesting to address this a year on.
Seb.
I think first, addressing Elliot's point, firstly on immigration reform, I think if presidents never did anything uncontroversial, I think they'd get very little done. I think you've got to, yeah. And while I'm not saying it will happen, I think there's a reasonable chance. I mean, there's been calls for it a lot of the past year, and if one thing people thought would happen in the past year, and with the changing demographics, you think that actually there's possibility of some Republican support. One of the main problems among the litany of problems they had in the 2012 election was, not just failing to get minorities on their side, but actively alienating them with their talk. And so I think there's certainly a chance of immigration reform going through. And he's not just talking about immigration reform. He did talk about inequality, which was linked to his minimum wage. And in fact, he has made moves and talking about drug reform. I think those will be quite slow. I don't think we'll see any landmark drug reforms anytime soon, but I think we'll be going in that direction. And I also think, obviously, in second term, foreign policy tends to become more important, because even as you move in later into your term, and the domestic kind of policy seems to focus, or eventually midterms and then the next election, obviously things happen you have no control over to the international realm that you get onto. And a final point, I'm sure probably moving on to this anyway, but a lot of what President can or can't do will be heavily dictated by the midterms this year. I mean, if he does get a Democratic House and Senate, then suddenly I think it opens up for him to do things he hasn't been able to do in the past, that is, terms so far. But if it goes more Republican or stays as it is, then I think we'll see more of the gridlock so far.
Brings it to our next question. How will this frame and affect the midterm elections later this year, Zoe?
Well, we saw last year with the Republicans and the budget, they got completely lambasted and sort of had to come back with their tails between their legs. You know, everyone said that the Democrats had sort of won in that situation. So hopefully, fingers crossed, they will appreciate if they do win the House again, you know, the priority that is bipartisanship, and they'll sort of learn from their mistakes. I say hopefully because it might not be the case, but in the State of the Union address, John Boehner even gave Obama a thumbs up. So perhaps there is hope in sort of bridging the gap between the two.
Yeah, I have to agree with her. Zoe. I hope that we'll see an environment in which more bipartisanship should occur. Actually, I was reading the other day that when it actually comes to how it will affect the midterms, apparently it's not going to affect the midterms that much. They're probably going to lose a seat in the Senate, but they still retain the Senate, the Democrats. The Republicans are still going to hold the majority in the House. So it's unfortunate because I'd like to see Obama being able to go ahead and do something, you know, go out on a real high. Unfortunately, I think he's going to have to use a lot of executive power.
All right, we're going to go to a song in a minute, but we'll go to Elliot first.
Yeah, I think that it's going to be pretty much the same as last time. I think the Republicans are in a little bit better shape than they were in 2012, maybe, than in the presidential elections, especially as, you know, the whole of Obama's economic policy was bolted onto Detroit, which went bankrupt earlier this year. That's caused massive problems with, you know, economic credibility. And that shows through the polls quite substantially. I could see more Republicans getting into the House. I can't see the Senate changing much. It'll be a bit of the same old, same old. Basically, the whole view that I take of American politics is that it's not amazing. There's a reason why it's not amazing
at all.
There
we have it, folks.
It's the way that it's set up is quite terrible, and the quality of the politicians they have, especially at the moment, is not very good. Not to say that our system is the best.
Have you considered writing a book on political philosophy with insightful statements
perhaps
like that, Elliot?
Eyes are squinting,
perhaps
ladies
I
and gentlemen. I mean, he's very passionate about this. Seb, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you. Firstly, briefly on Obama's economic policy. I don't think it was all pinned on Detroit. I don't think Detroit's completely...
It was for the Detroitians who got him in.
Detroitians. Well, he did actually... all bellies up. But you got to admit, in the same way we talk about economic policy and the UK, a recovering economy, which has been happening since just before the presidential election, you know, for Obama, will inevitably be in the same way, in fact, more fragile economy in the UK will benefit the coalition. So the improving economy will help. As for the midterms, I think there's still things that can change. I mean, given during the government shutdown, we thought, you know, Democrats were really going to have a good chance of really taking House and Senate. Now it would seem, unless there's a big change between then, it'll be more of the same in a gridlock and divided Congress.
Well, there we go. That was our debate on Obama's State of the Union. We'll be back next talking about Michael Gove and his admission that state schools should be more like private schools. Good evening and welcome back to The Big Picture. Thank you for joining us. Next, we'll be talking about Michael Gove and his admission that state schools should be more like private schools.
Yeah.
In a speech in East London, he wanted to break what he called the Berlin Wall between state and independent sectors. This could see state pupils taking the private school common entrance exam and state schools staying open for longer. Speaking at the London Academy of Excellence, he said that for decades, the dominant consensus has been that state education in England was barely satisfactory. But now he said the system was improving with better results, more people taking tougher subjects and fewer weak schools. He called for the possibility of a 9 or 10 hour day at schools for extracurricular activities. And as I said before, the possibility of a common entrance exam. So what I'd like to ask the panel, should state schools be more like private schools? We'll go to Luke first.
Well, look where we have got now in the ridiculous position where Michael Gove is suggesting that every student in every school in the UK should have to take this exam and they should all be tested, that sort of thing. Do you know why this is? It's because we've decided a long time ago that grammar schools are apparently have no position in the UK education system, and because of that we are now in a position where we're seemingly having to push up all the standards to the same point in a bizarre and ridiculous way.
Right,
we need to understand the differences that exist in people and in what they want to study,
And grammar schools embrace that. So let's have those standards for grammar schools. And then for the students who aren't as able or don't want such an academic education, want to push towards vocational studies, get them into a different one rather than just doing an across-the-board reform that's totally unnecessary.
Okay, Elliot.
I like how we've shoved everything, Matt, into one misconstrued ball of Michael Gove here, considering how I know how much the Labour Party loves Michael Gove. They love him to bits. The first thing I'd say is that, yes, Michael Gove did say he wanted them to be more like state schools, state schools to be more like private schools, and there is a Berlin Wall. But he was actually talking about, I want the results to be similar in the GCSEs and the A levels. So, you know, saying that he wants some sort of fundamental change is completely going the other way.
But the experience is still going to be different if they're going to have to take a common entrance exam.
The common entrance exam is not for all state schools. He's talking about very select, a small amount of schools. You know, he's actually moving forward. Perhaps grammar schools. That'd be a very good idea for my own personal reflections. And also on those lengthening of the school days, on another completely separate issue, I think there is something to look at here because we actually have the shortest school days in all of Europe. And, you know, there's something wrong here. When the French have start work at 8 o'clock and sometimes finish at 5, although they have Wednesdays off, admittedly, there is something, you know, to discuss that. I think we should be discussing all education ideas because actually having this free and open debate for the last 3 years has produced the best education system for a long time in this country.
Kieran.
It has come to a very odd situation in my life in which I actually agree with both Elliot and Luke. I cannot stand this criticism that comes constantly for this lefty liberal intelligentsia. Your Laurie Pennies and your Owen Jones amongst Michael Gove. I think he's doing a very good job. And this idea that they're going to start coming out with, that this is somehow his representation of the class system and it's an old Etonian speaking, blah, 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 is wrong. It's completely wrong. Because at the end of the day, I went to a state school. I know that my productivity was decreased by the fact that there were idiots at the back of the class. Now, if you want to bring grammar schools back, please do. If you want to bring a system back in which state schools, you require people to have a form of assessment to enter it, and then you're graded, so you basically bring back a grammar school system. Without a grammar school system actually in place, do it. Because actually, you know, you are right, Luke, when you say people have different skill sets, people have different ways of working, people have different ways of thinking, and not everyone who wants to be a carpenter wants to go to university and vice versa. So let's actually create a system in which people are able, which we are able to actually understand what people's aims are and what people's skills are, and then let's actually make a system in which these people are able to fulfill their aims. And on the issue of at work hours, you go to a place like Singapore, best educational system in the world, I believe, after Japan. I think my cousins are Singaporean, I'm half Singaporean. The amount they work their asses off is nothing compared to us. We need to have a major reassessment in this country of the actual dedication we give to our schoolwork. And there will be mothers and parents out there going, I don't want my kids working 9 hours a day. Tough, it's a new world. They do need to be working 9 hours a day.
They might not Luke. Have northern accents. Kate,
well, just to, they will, because that's the only accent I can do. And I'm from Leeds, so it's not racist.
But just to say, I mean, the point I was making at the start is I think actually, again, I agree. What Michael Gove is doing is a good idea, but the problem is it is still abiding by this fit everybody into one standard of school approach, and that just doesn't work. That doesn't work, and that's why we are going to see, or if we see policies like this, they are going to affect everyone, and some people they're not going to be right for, and they are going to have bad effects for. Other people it will work for, you know, but that's the problem when you try and teach. When you try and treat the education system as just one thing and try and fit everyone into it, and you don't accept and understand that some people work in different scenarios and in different environments better than other people. And if you've got your support there for people who want to achieve academically, then you can just match it with the support for vocational, and everybody wins.
Right, we'll go to Seb.
I think ultimately, to an extent, at least up to a level, you have to have kind of one size fits all to ensure that up to a certain age, every person who can, you're trying to make sure every person has a sufficient basic level of skills, and from then it does make sense to branch out and allow people to
it's
go
called
into
primary schools and secondary schools. So. Mm.
Well, exactly, but we're still talking about secondary school education, so I'm saying it's proper.
And you've said to get it up to a certain age, and you do get it up to a certain age. Everyone has a standard primary school education, and then if we're talking about streaming on academic grounds, that would be done ahead of secondary school.
Well, I'm saying it's appropriate to have a, to an extent, still a one size fits all until you go to GCSEs. You were talking about employers and training in going away from that. I think that should start maybe, you know, once you've done your GCSEs. I think it's too early to start pushing people towards vocational training just into secondary school. I think they may not, you know whether they want to do it. As for the other points, I think generally perhaps it's a bit hyperbolic to say there's a Berlin Wall between states and private schools, but I don't think there's too much of an actual controversial point beyond that. It's just saying there's a great bunch of standards. I don't think you're ever going to be completely able to bridge that, simply because there's going to be so much more funding and money available to private schools. But I think a longer day could work. I think you've got to remember the schools, private schools in the UK that do have longer days do tend to have longer holidays, but I'm sure you could, there's scope to make it a longer day without doing that. Or in a, so I think there's some sense in the forms, and I don't think they're completely controversial and crazy.
Okay, we'll go to Elliot.
You know, as Kieran has been saying, the lefty liberal dream of where we treat everybody exactly the same has utterly failed. We need to start treating people like individuals now when it comes to education. Otherwise, we're going to get a group of people who don't know very much about anything and can't do anything. Now, we've been having this for a long time, and Luke says, you know, there hasn't been any sort of substantial change, but there actually has. Even with just the small things with academies and for free schools,
well, hadn't been substantial change. I said that there is still a one-size-fits-all system in the majority of counties in the UK.
I disagree. I'm about to say why. What it is that we, with academies, and even more so with free schools, you do get the choice. You do get to be able to choose people and to cater for individuals inside the schools themselves. Now, and I can show this quite easily for the success in Nottingham, for example. Nottingham Council runs 2/3 of all the secondary school and the primary schools now, and 1/3 are roughly academies. There's a couple of free schools, but they're neither here nor there. The academy schools achieve they're twice as good GCSE results and Ofsted ratings than the state schools in Nottingham, and that's only because, and they've only had a couple of years to do this, so they've managed to completely turn around.
All right, Elliot,
in
we'll
a very
to,
quick period,
we'll
so it's a good
a
backing statistically for Gove's reforms.
The head of NetMums has reported a strong negative response from mothers on this. They've been arguing that more flexible arguing for more flexible working hours so they can get home in time for their children rather than stretching out their day. What do you think about that, Kieran?
I think on this one, I think I'm not quite sure what the argument NetMum are arguing there, because to me it seems if you extend the working hour, if you extend the amount of time that your kid has to spend at school, you are going to have to actually, you're going to actually save money in child costs, you know, and all those things. So I'm not quite sure what the actual complaint is. And this is what I'm coming back to, that there is an issue with a certain generation of people in this society who actually do not emphasise the necessity for education in our society enough. There are people out there who, when you say, I want to move the 6-hour day to a 9-hour day and give you a bit of a longer holiday, or even shorten the holiday, as I would, because I don't think these agrarian style holidays that we have now are worthwhile. I don't really understand what their complaint is. You're right. We live in a globalized world where you are competing with the Singaporeans, the Japanese, the Chinese, and we need to bring our game. We need to bring our A game, and we're not bringing our A game as a country anymore. We're not, and that is partly to do with the failures of state schools to complement my ability to be a very educated individual and Jordan Brown's ability to be an arsehole and actually should be in a carpenting school or something.
I think the argument they're making is for more family time. What do you say to that?
Your family time? What they on about? I don't understand this need for family. That's
okay.
What weekends are.
We'll go to
That's
Luke.
What weekends
I think
are.
That it's very peculiar criticism, because I know the debate, as I've understood it so far from a parenting point of view, has more been a case of this is going to save us money in childcare costs, because at the moment we're not getting that family time because I'm working 9 to 5, and by the time I've dropped off my kid at school for 8:45, I end up turning up to work late anyway. And then I go home, if I do go home at 5, and the kids already finished school for the past 2 hours anyway. So I'd be interested to hear a bit more about exactly what that criticism was from NetMums. But I mean, going back to the core issue here, I think it is clearly a case that private schools can achieve better exam results than state schools. I don't think that's necessarily just because they're private schools, but I think the culture that exists within there is the school has a lot more freedom to dictate exactly what it's doing. And I think that does actually, for probably the first time actually, I could say that I think Elliot's made a decent point with regards to the academies and the fact that they're able to shape themselves as they wish to be and according to the students who will thrive in that environment.
Is more testing for children a good thing, do we think, Elliot?
I think it is. You know, we already test for sporting ability, for music ability, for drama ability, and for all sorts of other, like, theatrical abilities, and yet we don't cater for those who want to be bright and show intelligence. I think that's madness. And when we have...
Can you still be bright and show...
You can be bright and show intelligence, but in an academic way. That's what I seem to mean. And I think that in counties where that has happened because they've retained grammar schools more, like in Lincolnshire, like in Buckinghamshire, they're actually seeing, even though Lincolnshire is not very well up in the wealth level, they're actually seeing a higher level of educational competence throughout a broad range of pupils because you have those appropriate skills.
Well, thank you. We're going to Seb.
I think we need to be careful about not over-testing and focusing on testing too much. And we want the criticisms of the education system has been, you know, focusing too much on, you know, exams and, you know, levels and, you know, numbers and in league tables. And I think it's partly a byproduct of too much testing. I think, however, it would be fair, perhaps, in some cases, certainly to have the entrance exam there and maybe, you know, do away with things like SATs, which seem to be increasingly meaningless.
They've gone, haven't they?
SATs?
Yeah.
I think they have, yeah.
For year six are still there. But.
Yeah, right. I think for some years they are, yeah. But Kieran, we'll go to you finally.
I think, as far as I'm aware, I can't understand of any other, way of genuinely testing people's academic abilities. And that is what we're doing. And you have to do that rigorously. We live in a globalised society. If you talk to my Singaporean cousins, they are tested and examined within a hilt of their life. They are constantly aware that there is another exam around the corner. There is never a time in which you are not preparing for an exam. And you'll get people who say, oh, well, that means they can't be children. Sorry, go raise your A game. Got to bring your A game in here. I think exams are the only way of truly testing people about their academic ability. And ultimately, in the end of the day, academics are what actually, you know, make you money.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there for now because we're a bit short on time. Welcome back to The Big Picture. Sorry for the sonic cut out there. There was a slight technical problem. We've had a change of schedule. We're going to go for the strikes on the tube in London at the moment. Ukraine, as valid a topic as it is, we just felt the London tube story would be a bit more
fruitful. It's breaking news, isn't it?
It really is breaking news. It's a 48-hour strike, the London Underground. Transport Commissioner Sir Peter Hendry said 86% of Londoners who usually pay for travel using their Oyster cards had done so as normal on Wednesday, but it's affected them massively. There's been two-thirds of the services haven't been running. It's due to saving £50 million through the losses of 960 jobs. They say it will modernise the industry and take people out of ticket offices, basically. Do we think this strike is justified? Well, we'll go to Kieran first.
This is why sometimes I despise the left. Basically, you have a
system here.
There's
been a lot of left bashing today.
No, it really is. It really is. It really is. Georgia Power is going to be pissed off with me today. this is why I despise the left. I genuinely do, for this reason, because you have a situation in which, look, you need to modernise the train systems. You need to modernise the underground. These are jobs which are no longer necessary. We have to accept that. We are in the 21st century. Boris Johnson was on Channel 4 News last night, and when he said that, look, when he promised that he would stop office closures, the iPhone hadn't even been invented. We live in a whole new world where the idea of queuing up and going to someone and getting a ticket off them is as archaic as, I don't know, as archaic as anything nowadays, right? You have to modernise, you have to revolutionise with the times, and the people who constantly say, oh, you've got to think about the 900 jobs, 500 people have already taken voluntary redundancy. No one is going to be forced out of a job, they will be rehoused somewhere else. I don't really understand what the fuss from the left is all about.
Luke.
And this is why nobody likes us.
I'll give you my sad victim story first of all. I actually have a friend who was affected by the strikes today, and I wanted to get in touch with him at the office earlier on, and he wasn't in because he was down in London, and he was 30 minutes late. He was 30 minutes late because of the tube strikes. And I just think that goes to show how terrible this is, because it's holding London to ransom. It's holding Londoners to ransom. Just to go off on the same vein that Kieran has. The Tube does not exist to provide jobs for people for the sake of providing jobs to people. It's not just some massive social project for the sake of getting people in employment. It exists as a service to get Londoners around. And the more efficient it can be and the cheaper it can be, the better. If that means we have to invest in electricity, invest in technology and change the way that it works, so be it. The point is, if we don't need those staff members and if keeping them on is only going to push up fares even higher, then absolutely, as a consumer, I think we need to come together as a society, a union of society members,
Elliot, well,
and say, no, we're not being held to ransom, and no, we're not going to let you force our tickets up just so we can keep you in an overpriced job.
It's like a little bit like Braveheart there. I don't know. I had that sort of feeling from Elliot. We'll go to Elliot.
Oh, well, I think Kieran and Luke have pretty much covered what I think about the thing itself, but I'd just like
this
to say,
most,
you know,
unusual disagreement today.
How good Boris Johnson has been over this thing. He proposed this for modernisation. Less than 3% of tickets are actually bought from people in ticket offices now. Most of the people who have not already got voluntary redundancy are going to be reassigned to actually helping people onto trains, like disabled people, considering it's a higher use of the Tube than ever before now. That's really good. But, you know, Bob Crowe's really been shown up. He refused to come to the negotiating table. Boris Johnson has said, stop the strike. We've got the negotiation table open, but he's called 2 48-hour strikes, and I bet you there'll be more disturbances then. And on a 30% turnout of union members, where not all of them would have voted to strike, you know, it's actually quite a damning indictment of the fact that how a small minority who are not even protecting their own jobs are going back for some sort of nostalgia. Of some sort of glory day of trains.
Bob Crowe has said, though, that he wants talks. He's completely willing
to
have talks.
Yeah, well, he hasn't
talks.
Come to the table.
Please let me finish. He said he wants to
cruise.
Have some talks, but actually that the other side just isn't budging. And
well, Boris
they refuse not to talk to them
well,
as well.
Well, that's not true at all. Boris Johnson said today, come to my office. He said that all week. He said that on the air to Bob Crowe. He said, just don't strike.
I think in fairness, because I think the issue is more what they want to talk about. And Boris has said quite clearly that we're not talking about this because this is not an issue that's up for negotiation because the technology is there because we don't need the jobs. I think that explains it. Sorry, Seb.
Seb, go on.
I think on the issue of whether Bob Crowe or Boris Johnson was up for the negotiating table, I think in these situations it's always in some ways difficult to tell. Every party accuses the other one of being at fault and not negotiating. I'm not entirely sure exactly who was to blame, but obviously it's best if they both do actually get to the negotiating table. I almost feel like, given the consensus, I should suddenly go play devil's advocate and go raving lefty to an OTU, but I don't think I will. I think, I think on the point that you can't just protect jobs for job's sake, and if they are useless, then there is really no point in just keeping them for their sake. And I think I would agree on that. I think it does seem the case that these ticket offices are no longer used for any purpose than keeping them in jobs, it probably is better to let them go and, as you said, to ensure they can get work elsewhere and ease the transformation. But I don't think it really does anyone any good to purely keep them in their jobs just because you don't want to let them go.
Kieran.
No, exactly. I went to London over Christmas. I had a lovely time. I saw the Book of Mormon. Everyone should go see it. It was lovely. But what happened to me was I was using a ticketing machine and I needed to buy a ticket. It was only about a fiver. I put 20 quid in and they said, oh, we're out of change. 15 quid. Go get 15 quid from the office. I went to the office and the man refused to give me my money. The argument I heard was actually, oh, maybe not even tickets, but to deal with complaints and to deal with, you know, people's needs and issues. They're completely unable to even do that. This is an unnecessary service. I had to bring up the phone people to get my 15 quid back, right? The fact at the end of the day is that most people who live within London use Oyster cards. The rest of us are perfectly capable of using the credit card systems provided, as you do when you get the metro in Paris. We need to modernise. We don't have mining. We don't have people putting mine into the trains anymore because they don't run on coal.
What about the argument that lots of deaf and blind people actually get their tickets from ticket offices and they can't get them from machines?
Well, I think we've got to look at how we can make the technology that's there even better than it is at the moment and how we've got to be able to adapt it for those people. The point is, we can't simply hold up the technology that has the potential to make actually ticket purchases even easier for these people, because they don't need to talk to the grumpy ticket man on the other end that Kieran's just spoken about. You know, we need to make sure that actually the money we're saving we can put back, and we can make sure that there is adaptive technology that's going to benefit these vulnerable people so that they can be supportive through the increased technology and technologicalization of these ticket
new
machines.
Word,
I made that word.
Yeah, new word.
I saw a guide dog turn on a kettle once, so I'm just
really?
Saying anything's possible.
Wow.
On a more serious point about disabled and blind people and the like, you know, actually, there was going to be 200 jobs of those people who were behind the glass in the ticket office are now going to be outside helping them. You see a lot of these people now, because they have employed more people to actually help people rather than let them fend for themselves, you know, to get onto the check. To get onto the train if they need be, you know, help with the barriers, help with the machines maybe. You know, this is actually a service which is going to be more hands-on rather than have 20 people, as it was in the past, behind a glass barrier, unable to come out and help you, but only able to, you know, say. I think we're going to have a revolution. If we're going to move forward, especially with Crossrail in London, we need to have a revolution with the trains. And I think that the TfL, well, the leadership of the TfL are just not with it.
Seb?
Well, it seemed to me at first, Kieran, that you needed to make a complaint to the person about that not getting your £15, and then suddenly it would be his purview, but...
What?
Well, you said...
Oh, purview! Oh!
Slight slip of the tongue there. Misheard the word.
I said it right. He heard it wrong, I should
highlight. You did. Apologies, you did. Yes. Carry on.
As for point on disabled use, I'm not... And I'm sure there have been more studies about this. If there are great problems as a result of this, then I would, you know, advise them to really look into strongly ways to minimise that, ways to update the system. But it does seem that that there are more people being employed around the station to avoid that. So I'll work on this. I'm not an expert in this, but working on the assumption that these staff will be enough, and that there will be enough support for disabled people who do find the tickets harder. Then, if that's not a great issue, which doesn't seem like with these new staff, then it would seem that the only purpose for keeping these jobs is...
Well, undoubtedly, there'll be an equality impact assessment they'll conduct with it, because they conduct that sort of thing for everything. So, well, I think it's probably worth looking if there is an issue that arises
Kieran
from that, doing the right measures.
And we're also forgetting,
not to improve
we're also forgetting that actually the majority of Londoners do use Oyster cards now. And, you know, the things that you can do with mini telecoms, and I don't know really, but there are things available to help make it easier for people who are disabled to actually ensure that they have money and they ensure they are able to use the underground. The main issue for them is actually accessibility, which hopefully is something that will be able to be improved with the new money that they save through these job cuts. So it's all win for disabled people, really.
There we have it. Fair enough. Anyone else would like to say on this at all?
I think Bob Crow's outside, but if we can just keep him out there, then
he does have a lovely tan.
What's your issue with Bob Crow then?
My issue with Bob Crow is that he benefits from the increased attention that is paid to people because of these strikes. He is a very militant man who wants to see his union strike. You know, he's very good at being able to talk up his people and in order to try and motivate them and get them into action. But actually, I mean, to that extent, full respect to him, he's doing his job as a union boss, but it's quite greedy and it's very much about his self-interest. And I don't think his self-interest is actually compatible with the interest of the rest of society generally.
He's publicly said today that he does not call strikes for the sake of it.
What
do you think of that? What do you think
of that? He did it under Livingston as well, even though he was a member of the militant people in the 1980s. You know,
the militant people.
Well, he was. No, it was the militant group, the militant tendencies of Labour in the parliamentary party.
Yes. Okay, fair enough.
You know, Bob Crow is one of these characters who says, you know, I'm down with the people, but then he's off on his £5,000 cruise holiday and living in his £100,000 council house. And I think he needs to get a grip here. This is a man who earns substantial amounts of money, and yet it's costing the taxpayer, you know, coming into millions now personally, and I think it's very unfair. You know, Bob Crow himself, if he would take less of a salary, if he would not spend on his money on council houses, if he would go to, say, France instead of to the Bahamas 1 year, he'd be saving people jobs, and he'd probably be doing more than he would do from his negotiations with Boris Johnson
and
the TfL.
On that note, we will leave it there.